It's not enough to be a hero, doer, you must be. Praising, giving thanks to Yahweh for his love, his mercy. Come out of her, my people. That's what he told me. Is it a physical matter?
Say Shabbat Shalom. Good morning, everybody. Boker Tov. And this is a, well, there's a lot to talk about today. I'm going to introduce this the way I sometimes do, by saying on Erev Shabbat, remember what I try to do is to go through the whole thing in some detail. Obviously, that's been done and will be done today with the recordings here as well, so you'll have a chance to hear about the specifics of hopefully the whole Torah portion. But what I want to do in this session is now emphasize a couple of the specifics of things that I want to look at in some more detail. And in particular, I made some promises last week about things we would talk about this week as well, having to do, among other things, with this concept of without prejudice. And I think there are aspects of that that fit. So we'll do all of that today. If there's questions, by all means, put those up, and we'll go over those too. So let me start by saying it this way. The Torah portion begins in Leviticus chapter 26, verse 3, one of those reminders that I think is so important. I always want to emphasize when I see them, and they appear over and over again. If, he says, if you will do these things, in particular, if you'll keep my statutes, shamar, hear, listen, obey, do, and note that it's not just his instruction that he's talking about here. There are specifics. The word here is be kuchotai. And that literally has the implication of statutes. And then it talks about mitzvotai as well, commandments. So these are, they're legal terms, but these are statutes and commandments. These are things you're supposed to keep. And, of course, to do them. Then all of these good things will happen. And if not, we're going to see something similar in Deuteronomy, but with a big difference. Because it doesn't quite have, when Moses repeats this, the happy ending part of it. Anyway, good things if you obey, bad things if you don't. This one is particularly graphic when it comes to the bad things, because it says, look, I'm gonna give you an opportunity. And then it's going to get seven times worse, and then seven times worse, and seven times worse, and seven times worse. You do the math, that's a whole lot of times worse. 50 times 50, right, would be 2,500 times worse. And we're talking 49 times 49 here. So you get the idea anyway. He's making a real important point. Bottom line is this. It's a stark choice. Real black and white. The contrast ought to be clear, and that's key. There's been some emphasis already this morning, and I concur. Bottom line, among all the things that we see condemned in Scripture, is absolutely idolatry. So let's pause for a second. We've got this stark contrast laid out. Had a discussion last night with some folks, Kevin, who's on here today, and again, in particular, about, like so many places in the Torah, this is one of them. Some would say it might be the most. I'm not sure if I go there. But anyway, one of the places where there's so much oral tradition, so much midrash, so much discussion. Well, what does all of this really mean? We get to chapter 27. I'm going to suggest that's perhaps even a little bit harder for us to wrap our heads around. I'm not sure that I completely do understand all that's talked about in chapter 27. And I guess that's probably true. I'm not sure that I completely understand anything that's discussed anywhere in the Torah. We just kind of see through a glass darkly. We go through it over and over again. We learn a little bit more. So I don't let that stop us from at least trying and studying and trying to show ourselves approved and so forth. But this one seems to be a little bit more obtuse in some respects than others. But again, I think there's some things that are worth looking at here and we can learn from. So let me just lay out one or two or three or maybe half a dozen of the things that people that have looked at this midrash and written about it and let iron sharpen iron about for literally centuries at this point have pointed out. One, you'll hear a lot about the you in the communal sense. Most of the Orthodox will say this is about the Jews. The Jews need to do these certain things in a communal sense of communal responsibility. Well, I think there are aspects of truth in that. I do think it's bigger than that as well. There's a nice teaching that I heard David Foreman do, and he, of course, is not the first, but others have pointed out, if you look at the things that are laid out here, you see all the good thing that's going to happen to you. If you will do these things, you'll get rains in the proper season, the land will yield its produce, the trees of the field will yield their fruit. When sowing and reaping times come, you'll have enough, and literally you will be satisfied. And we're going to see the contrast here. Later on, you're going to eat and eat and eat and not be satisfied. And when I look at that, I said this last night, I can't help but think, you know, if there's a verse that, to my mind, points to genetically modified Franken blankety blank, it's that one, verse 26 of chapter 26. When I break the staff of your bread, 10 women will bake your bread in one oven. They'll deliver your bread again by weight. You'll eat. Oh, you'll stuff yourselves, basically. But you will not be satisfied. And I'm thinking, okay, how much genetically modified Franken crap do you have to eat in order to, well, cause your innards to explode? We've seen that with farm animals. They eat this genetically modified corn, and their liver and kidney and even their intestines, in the case of pigs, get so weak that they can't even be used to stuff sausage anymore. Yuck! In other words, the nutrition is gone from the food, is one way to read it. That's one way I would read it. People eat and eat and eat, and it doesn't nourish their bodies. They're not satisfied. Another way to think of it is, well, NutraSweet, aspartame, these other poisons that aren't really food or sweetness or anything else at all. How do you note, what does the neurotoxin aspartame do? Well, among other things, yeah, it destroys your neural system, your brain cells, and so forth. But it also has this interesting characteristic. People that drink Diet Cokes become obese. How ironic is that? Because they aren't satisfied by sweetness. They get where they crave it. It's kind of like an addiction. Like cocaine for your sweet tooth. And yet they're not satisfied. Anyway, all I'm pointing out here by way of introduction is, when you look at the blessings and the curse and the stark contrast here, there's no shortage of things that we can look at in our society today and see beginning to play out. Is there more to it? Perhaps. Are we at some point of, you know, 7 times 7, or where are we along that continuum? I'm not sure yet, but I'm going to suggest that there's a lot of bad stuff coming down. We can see it. What else will we hear about this? Well, I mentioned the Eden thing. In other words, that if, well, at least I started to mention it. If you go through the parallels here and compare them to Genesis 1 and on into chapter 2, it talks about how Elohim made man, put him there, and said, "Okay, I want you to take dominion over all of these things." And I won't go through it, but if you do, and the sages have, you'll see that there are some pretty interesting parallels. And from that, they draw the conclusion that just maybe what is being talked about here is a return to the land. Many, many times, it's all about the land. It's about the Gan Eden. It's about the Garden of Eden. If you will do these things, give the land its rest. We've just finished talking about last portion. Take care of the stuff I have made you a good steward over. Then all this good stuff will happen. If you don't, not so good. Matter of fact, worse than not so good. So you've got those parallels. Another one that you see in here in verse 6 is peace in the land. And once again, the sages will pick on aspects of that and make some very good points grammatically and otherwise, comparing places in Scripture like Isaiah chapter 45. I've got a note here, verse 7. Peace is everything. I'll give you peace in the land. It has been observed by people who point out that there really are differences in the sexes. In other words, men react to things differently than women do. Whether or not the modern society that's well down this road of cursing will admit that or not. Back to Genesis 1, male and female, he created them. He did make us different. Women tend to focus more on security and on peace. It's kind of the way they're wired. And men focus on other things. But nevertheless, this element shows up here in a big way. I'll give you peace in the land. You'll lie down. No one will make you afraid. The evil beast will cease out of the land, nor will the sword go through your land. You'll chase your enemies. They'll fall before you by the sword. Well, wait a minute. Says Rashi and a number of others, is that a contradiction here? If the sword doesn't go through your land, what are we talking about? Well, we're clearly talking about somebody that is chasing 100, hundreds shall chase 10,000, by your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. But the sword's not going to go through the land. Well, so some of the sages will say what that indicates is literally the enemies are killing each other. That this might be an implication of friendly fire. Now, I find that an interesting concept. We'll come back to that one as well. I'll have respect for you, make you fruitful and multiply. That, too, harkens to the Garden of Eden. And I guess the last thing with respect to peace. When you look at this, what you see is a peace in more than one way. That there is both an internal and an external form of peace. You can have peace in your hearts, you can have peace in terms of no external enemies, and you can have an internal form of peace that says no strife among you within your lands, within your communities. And all these other good things. Okay, so we've got that by way of introduction. A couple of concepts, like I said, that I'll talk about again. This one of friendly fire, and certainly this issue of the stark choice. The contrast. And then let's lay out one more. I've already talked about idolatry. Is this about idolatry? I will say absolutely, positively. It's a theme that runs throughout Scripture. It is the reason why, ultimately, both the northern and southern kingdoms, Israel and Judah, went into exile and were scattered. At least the northern kingdoms were scattered. Eventually, some of Judah came back to the land. But we've still got issues to this very day. In addition to idolatry, and maybe it's the very same thing, just an aspect of idolatry, we find people that did not obey the Shemitah commandments, the seven-year rest, and the Yovel, or the Jubilee, the 50-year setting aside of debts and returning to the original land. So there's no question about this, that there's a large element of in the land and things associated with the land. And if this is about the Garden of Eden, Gan Eden, then yeah, that too has to do with a return to the land. So let me start it this way, as I'm going to point out that there are some parallels and things that we can see, and people will say rightfully, well, we're not in the land. We're clearly already out of the land. So, can we even do these things? Should we even try? I'll ask it as a question, starting with, can we see that these curses are beginning to come upon us again, even though we're out of the land? Do you think there's a message there? If we're looking to return to the land, and he's promised all this chastening, and we're still not even getting ourselves back to the place where we need to be to return to the land, at least not collectively, if we're accepting that this is maybe a collective thing, well, then what? Well, I've said this many, many times. I am a firm believer in patterns, in cycles, that if there's a single thing, perhaps, that characterizes the difference between the Hebraic mindset and the Greek, Roman, pagan mindset, it's that understanding. It's not that history is linear. Things don't just continually improve. Evolution towards a higher plane. You can be like gods. No. We make the same mistakes. Solomon had it right. There's nothing new under the sun. What has been is what will be. What has been done is what shall be done. Ain't nothing new under the sun. Y'all just keep doing it over and over and over again. The cycles repeat. And of course, as Ezekiel noted, there are wheels within wheels, cycles within cycles. We see cycles that add up. Bigger waves becoming tidal waves, and then they settle back down. So literally, what you have is not just sine waves, right? A pure sine wave. You have more like an orchestral symphony building to a climax with sine waves that add up and sine waves that destructively interfere, as it's called, and subtract out. And so where are we in the pattern? You know, as we're riding upon this one wave. Are we close to the top, close to the bottom, somewhere in the middle? Are we on the slope of a huge wave crashing downhill, maybe? Where are we in this 7 times 7 times 7 times 7 thing? Oh, well, we're not in the land, that's for sure. Can we still recognize that we're on this wave and what direction it might be headed? It's important. Let me remind you, too, that in the major events of more modern history, forgetting the Medes and the Persians and Rome and Greece and Babylon and those things, just for a second anyway. Well, you've got, within the 20th century, you've got Stalin and Hitler, Pol Pot, Idi Amin, number of other dictators, tyrants, mass murderers, Mao Zedong, and probably the American regime. All of those come to mind, and you know what? Not one of the ones I named were in the land. Certainly the Jewish people, if you will, and the gypsies and others that were murdered by Hitler, the millions that were murdered by Mao, they weren't in the land. Can bad things still happen when we're out of the land if we're not walking in obedience? You betcha. Can they still happen even if we are at least partially walking in obedience? Yeah. Where are we in the pattern of 7 times 7 times 7 times 7? I'm not necessarily going to be able to answer that question, but I'm going to point you to some directions, and we're going to talk about the news, obviously, in the process of this today. And at least I can probably share my general impression with you that the big wave is headed downhill, and that those of us who understand what's going on ought to be taking some very specific actions. Certainly a teshuva at the front of that list, right? Recognize the idolatry, separate ourselves from it, and come out of it. But there's probably more that we can do, too. And I want to talk about those things. So back to this list, to this stark contrast, to these choices that are made. And like I said, there are lots of discussions that the sages will have about all the many lessons that can be drawn from this. One of the ones that interested me was, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments, im bechutotai, bechukotai, and you do these things, then I'll give you rains, good stuff, if you are walking in obedience, bad stuff if you're not. Well, then the question becomes, which? Which statutes and commandments? Well, the usual answer that I will give people is all of them. But we can't clearly walk in all of them. Again, we're not in the land anyway. There's a lot of them we can't do. Is it specifically talking about the land? There are some of the Midrashim that would argue, well, we're really talking about the Shemitah and the Yovel, because that's what they've been talking about here, and so that's the key element. Well, maybe. How about, let's talk about it from the other perspective. If we can't keep them all, which ones should we keep? Well, that's what they're saying. Pay attention especially to the ones about the land. Well, we're not in the land. Can we still give our land a cyclical rest? Yeah, we can do all those things. We may not even know exactly what year is the Shemitah and the Yovel year. I know there'll be a lot of people that will discuss that nowadays and say maybe we can figure it out and get an indicator on where we are in the end times calendar. Fine. But let me just suggest something else, too, in terms of logic. Can we be disobedient to all of them? Normally, we don't think about it from that standpoint. In other words, there are some commands we just can't keep. So I guess we're in neither disobedience or obedience. But there are other commands we can keep, a lot of which, obviously, we're not keeping. The ones, for example, that would say, you're not to lie with a man like with a woman. Well, that's being institutionalized. They want to license it. They want to say it's every bit as good as your marriage and so forth. So not only can we essentially ignore certain commands, a society can say those things that God says are abomination, we're going to sanctify, to set apart, make them devoted things. I'm going to come back to that concept in a second. And it's almost like somebody's got a checklist in Washington or in America. Has there been much of anything that God says don't do that they aren't saying, oh yeah, we love it. We love, 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 love it. We're going to do it. We're going to show you on TV. We're going to make movies about it. We're going to glorify it, sanctify it. We're going to make it a sacrament. Abortion, anyone? Hey, it's the litmus test for a Supreme Court. Just us. I'm hard-pressed. The hot ones that I hit, the things that seem to be the root of the coming 7 times 7 times, maybe at least 7, that looks like it lies ahead, has to do with dishonest weights and measures. We've built the entire world's money supply on what the creator of the universe calls an abomination, and literally promises will be destroyed, because these abominations don't last. Never seen one yet that hasn't. So, if you had a checklist, dishonest weights and measures, check. one set of law for you and the stranger that dwells among you? Oh, no, peon. We got a different set of law for just us. And even the written law doesn't apply to you guys. We'll come back to that when we talk about the news in a minute. So you get this checklist. Disobedient to this? Male-on-male homosexuality? Check. Dishonest wage and measures? Check. Getting rid of him and not allowing his name to be spoken? We did that a long time ago. But how about putting other gods in his place and not even letting his name be mentioned in the schools? Check, 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 check. So here's where I'm proposing this. It says, if you will keep all my commands, walk in my statutes, keep my commandments. Before that, last week, you keep my Sabbaths. Well, no, we don't do that either. Then all these good things will happen. Well, how about if you take a checklist and you take every single one of the things he says do, and you say, no, no, do not. We'll mandate that. By the way, that's where the Catholic Church got into such a wonderful mode of essentially saying Judaism is outlawed. You want to prove you're not a Jew? Eat an Easter ham on Ishtar Sun God Day Sunday. Keep the feast of Mithra's birthday, not those Jewish things. They too had a checklist, and they said if it was quote-unquote Jewish, now that word doesn't appear in the Bible, really, in an honest translation, in reference to the feasts of Yah. They're his feasts. We belabor that one frequently. But nevertheless, you see a similar pattern. Hey, was there anything negative that happened in the so-called Dark Ages? I guess so. Where were they on the 7 times 7 times 7 times 7 scale? If we can take every single thing that he says keep and not keep any of them, just maybe, I will suggest, with the checklist, we can work our way up, or at least somebody can try to put in place a communal society, and I chose that word carefully, that will literally manage to do all of the things that he says not to do and walk contrary to his ways. If for all of this you will not hearken to me, walk contrary to me, then I will walk contrary to you in fury. I'll chastise you 7 times more for your sins. You'll eat the flesh of your sons and eat the flesh of your... Uh-oh. Are we doing that? I'm just thinking about the PepsiCo flavorizing things having to do with abortion. I'm thinking about communist China, where there are reports, too many reports to ignore, from too many witnesses to ignore, that that's exactly what's doing. That aborted baby is a delicacy. How disgusting. And yet how true. We're definitely, any way you slice it, at least worldwide, we're pretty far up the 7 times 7 times 7 scale. I'll destroy your high places, cut down your sun pillars, cast your carcasses upon the carcasses of your idols, he says, and my soul shall abhor you. I'll make your cities a waste, bring your sanctuaries into desolation, and I'll not smell the savor of your sweet odors. I'll bring your land into desolation. Your enemies that dwell therein will be astonished at it, and I'll scatter you out among the nations. Well, now we know this has already happened. I'll draw out the sword after you. And we also know that it's happened more than once, really. We've seen multiple exiles, multiple scatterings, some bigger and some smaller. But again, the cycles repeat. The land will then have its rest, even the rest which it didn't have in your Sabbaths when you dwelt upon it. The rest of the world, too. Now, I mentioned that there's a happy ending here. Got to mention that at this point, too, because after all this bad stuff plays out, those that are left of you will pine away in iniquity, in their iniquity, in the lands of their enemies, in the lands of the, and also in the iniquities of their fathers shall they pine away with them. And then they shall confess their iniquity, the iniquity of their fathers, the treachery which they committed against me, and that they've walked contrary to me. And then I will also walk contrary to them, bring them into the land of their enemies, but... Here it comes. If perchance these uncircumcised of heart be humbled, and then they be paid the punishment of their iniquity, then I will remember. And the sages make a big deal of this too, because it's in reverse order. My covenant with Jacob, then the covenant before that, my covenant with Isaac, and then the covenant before that, also my covenant with Abraham. I'll remember, and I will remember the land. Interesting. The land shall I forsake and without them, and it shall be paid. She, the feminine form of the verb is, or the verb of the noun are used here, she shall be paid her Sabbaths while she lie desolate without them, and the punishment of their iniquity. Because, even though they rejected mine ordinances and their soul abhorred my statutes, for all that, when they're in the land of their enemies, I will not... Oh, is this us? Sounds like it. I will not reject them, nor will I utterly abhor them to destroy them utterly and break my covenant with them. For, here comes the signature line, Ani Yahuwah Elohechem. I'll remember for their sakes the covenant. These are the statutes and the ordinances and the laws, the Torot, which Yahuwah made between him and the B'nai Israel in Mount Sinai by the hand of Moshe. All right. Got a couple more things to lay out. Two things in particular. That's kind of what I would call the gist of the portion. And ends in chapter 26. Well, we still got the last chapter in the book to go before we finish with Leviticus. And it says, Yod Hey Vav Hey spoke to Moshe, saying, when the children of Israel speak to them, and when a man shall clearly utter a vow, there's a word here used, palah, and there's some discussion about what that does mean as well. Some translations that I've looked at in the Bible don't even bother to render it, at least not specifically. But it sounds like this is some kind of a singular, if you will, or marvelous, or set apart. Somebody else last night had another good synonym for it that I liked. Amazingly unique kind of a vow of persons. Then there's a description here of how it's going to be valued. But the element that kind of rings home in this is this idea of something that is vowed to be set apart. Where I want to go to set up the next couple of things we're going to talk about is verse 21. Because there's a word that's used there in the Hebrew, and in the English, it generally gets rendered as devoted. Talks about the Shemitah and the Jubilee, in this case the Jubilee, this field. We're going to be able to set aside certain things, property, fields, and also people, unto Yah. And sometimes they can be redeemed. Field can be redeemed. The laws of the Jubilee still apply. When the field goes out in the Jubilee, it shall be set apart unto Yod Heh Vav Heh as a field devoted. Devoted. Ha Cherem. Ha Cherem. Ha Cherem. The chet's kind of hard. You have to work on that, and I'm still working on that. Ha Cherem. As a field devoted. Well, that's the first time that word is used in the Torah. What does it mean? Verse 28, we see it over and again. No devoted thing that a man may devote unto Yahuwah of all that he has, whether of man or beast or field of his possession, shall be sold or redeemed. Every cherem thing, every devoted thing, is most set apart, kadosh, holy, unto Yod Heh Vav Heh. Verse 29 says, nothing devoted, cherem, that may be devoted of men shall be ransomed. Now, sometimes, now this gets rendered as the ban. Huh? Again, this would seem confusing. But the reason why I'm dwelling on this for a second is because I think it fits with this pattern of sevens and of things that involve themselves with idolatry. And if you think about a sine wave, a pendulum, a cycle, something that repeats the same pattern, cycles within cycles, wheels within wheels over and over again. You notice that there's two extremes, right? There's one extreme, the other extreme. That's kind of the nature of a lot of the Hebrew words. Kadesh, kadosh, set apart, is another one of those very similar words. And matter of fact, it's almost in the same context that we find this word cherem here. Because something can be set apart for more than one reason. Literally, it can be holy unto Yod Heh Vav Heh, like the sign, the inscription that the priests wore. Or it can be set apart because it's absolutely, positively an abomination unto him. He doesn't want anything to do with it. And that same word, kadesh, kadosh, you put different vowel pointers in it, and it can mean, for example, a male temple prostitute serving an idolatrous place you wouldn't want to go. And we're going to see that that is exactly the case with this word cherem, devoted. Like I mentioned, first used is Leviticus 27:21, and it's devoted, it's set apart to him. But if you go to the Strong's, and I don't very often do this, but a lot of times people will write these numbers down and they can look it up if they can't find it any other way. This is Strong's 2764, and it's based on 2763. It occurs 38 times in 31 verses, it says. First one is in Leviticus 27:21. This field, when it goes out in the Jubilee, is a field devoted. The possession thereof shall be of the priests. And in 28, we see it again. And then in 29. But then we see it again in Numbers. Everything devoted in Israel shall be mine, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, or shall be thine. And then, one of the verses that I realized when I was doing some of this looking up earlier is another verse that I quote all the time. It's from the end of Deuteronomy chapter 7. Nor shall you bring an abomination into your house, lest you be a cursed thing, devoted thing, lest you be harem like it. Huh? Yeah. See, here's the opposite use of a similar word. You shall utterly detest it. You shall utterly abhor it. It is a devoted, cursed, harem thing. Who's it devoted to? Seems to be the only real difference here. Devoted to him? Great. Devoted to another god? Idolatry? Well, that's what we're talking about in this portion. That's how you get to the wrong end of the same cycle. The 27, or the 7 times 7 times 7 times maybe as much as 7 stuff. We see it again in Deuteronomy 13, which is the one that talks about the false prophets, the chapter. You shall not cleave to the accursed thing to your hand, that Yahuwah may turn from the fierceness of his anger to show you mercy. And then it talks in places like Joshua about the accursed, set-apart Harem city. Keep yourself away from it, lest you make yourselves accursed. Interesting. Over and over again, this idea of something being devoted, well, it matters to whom it's devoted. Verse 29, back again in chapter 27, says, nothing devoted, or under the ban, is how sometimes it's rendered, that may be devoted of men shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. So part of the confusion in this chapter may stem from the fact that if we don't really kind of have this Hebraic understanding that the same word, and we do see this occasionally in English, can't think of an example off the top of my head, probably won't come to me, but we do see things that can be set apart for, well, two very, very, very different reasons. Opposite ends of the scale. All right, questions, comments at this point? Because I'm going to pause there. If there's any that I missed from the other room, from the Talking Torah room, pop those on the screen. Last night when I was going through this, I actually introduced the Torah portion by starting first in the Haftorah portion, which is quite interesting. It's Jeremiah chapter 16 into chapter 17. And ironically, it's talking about a time when this has come to pass. Jeremiah, of course, is a prophet during the time when we're seeing this division and we're seeing the casting out. And, of course, he's warning about it, kind of, if you will, in the sense of looking at it from the middle of the cycle. And the Haftorah begins in 16:19. It's one of the verses you'll hear quoted here all the time. O Yahuwah, my strength and my fortress, my refuge in the day of affliction. Think about that one. The nations, the Goyim, shall come to you from the ends of the earth. And they'll say, surely our fathers have inherited lies, worthlessness, and unprofitable things. That part we quote all the time. But because this is the Haftorah for today, I'm going to go a little further. Therefore, behold, this once I will cause them to know. I'll cause them to know my hand and my might, and they shall know. Now here's where this irritates me. I'll quote the King James and then we'll get it right. And they shall know that my name is the Lord. Yuck. Okay, it's not what it says. There are a couple places in the King James that are just particularly egregious in that. They shall all know my name is the Lord. Well, that's my title for crying out loud. If there's any place that you ought to put it in there right, it's here. Because what it says is they shall know that my name is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And the irony, of course, is we're still being lied to about that. They still don't know. They read this and think, my name is the Lord. Well, if it's important enough that he put it in his book, maybe it's important enough that we render it right. But that kind of leads us into this next section, and it shows just a little bit of how deep the deception goes. And again, that's one of the themes that I think is really important today as well. The sin of Judah, says chapter 17, verse 1. Now, we're talking about northern kingdom having literally been dispersed and sent out. But remember, Judah, too, goes into bondage, the southern kingdom. The sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron, engraved with the point of a diamond on the tablets of your heart and the horns of your altar. While their children remember all of this idolatry, their altars, their wooden images, the green trees on the high hills, I, says the Creator of the universe, will give as plunder your wealth, all of your treasures, and your high places of sin within your borders, and you, even yourself, shall let go of your heritage which I gave you, and I'll cause you to serve your enemies in the land which you do not know, for you have kindled a fire in my anger. He says, interesting. It's exactly what was promised here. Now, here's the part that I'm pointing to, because when we get ready to go to the news, which is where I'm headed next, I want you to think about these couple of verses. Cursed, he says, cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength. This week, got word that the Department of Agriculture, yeah, just like every other three-letter agency in government, from the IRS to the ATF to the Bureau of Land Management to DHS and you name it, is buying guns, and this time it's fully automatic submachine guns that you mere peons are not allowed to possess. They're called Class 3 firearms if it fires a burst. And peons can't have that because it's a weapon that was intended for the militia. Isn't that ironic? Take everything and turn it upside down. So here you go. Cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength. I'll let you draw your own conclusions. Whose heart departs from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. He'll be like a shrub in the desert. He won't see when good comes. He'll inhabit the parched places in the wilderness in a salt land which is not inhabited. Contrast. Blessed is the man who trusts in Yahuwah and whose hope is in Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. He is like a tree planted by the water, spreading out its roots by the river. He will not fear when heat comes. Its leaf will be green. He will not be anxious in the year of drought. I'm thinking of what we're hearing in the news every day about California, which is now on fire. Nor will cease from yielding fruit. And then verse 9 is another one of these verses that I like to quote a whole lot because it seems so apropos nowadays. The heart, says the prophet, is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, search the heart, attest the mind, to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings. Okay, let's pause. We got a couple things on the table. Devoted things. Set apart things. Things that are literally pledged to, some kind of idols or to him. And there doesn't seem to be anything but a huge gap in between those, particularly so far as he is concerned. Be careful, by the way. Don't pledge things to him unless you intend to keep them. There is some discussion in chapter 27 about redemption, valuation, and certain things can be redeemed. Certain things that are pledged, particularly devoted, I guess, accursed, obviously cannot be. Where do we start in the news review? I picked this one because one of the things that came up towards the end of last week's Torah portion seems to be playing out in the news really big this week to me. It has to do with this idea of one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. Shows up a number of times in the scriptures. It's important. It would seem justice, justice you shall pursue. One law. Lands like Sodom and Gomorrah that didn't do that, got into trouble. So I introduce this week's news with not necessarily the most important story. There's several stories that I think are interesting, important. But this just kind of sets the stage. This comes from a Kentucky senator, Rand Paul, who put a letter, was an op-ed contribution this week to the New York Times. And it has to do with this concept of, well, one law. Maybe he didn't put it that way, but that's how I read it. And the senator from Kentucky has a problem with a nominee from the emperor to the what is now laughably called the federal judiciary, the bench. There's a fellow named David J. Barron, professor of law at Harvard. Now, by the way, if I had kids, I wouldn't put them in a place like Harvard at this point, given this cretin is infecting young minds with poison any more than I would throw them off a cliff. A Harvard law professor, former acting assistant attorney general. Oh, there you go. He probably fit really well there. Forgive my my outright cynicism and total disgust. Maybe just because when you see people that are this much in violation of the Torah and the Constitution, it's hard not to recognize them for what they are, a liar who the truth is not in. All right, is that clear enough, I guess? Anyway, he has been nominated for a seat on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. When he was an official, as it turns out, in the Department of Just Us and their Office of Legal Counsel, how appropriate. He wrote at least two legal memos. Turns out there were a whole bunch of other ones that have now been unearthed, although you can't see them. That's the point here. Justifying execution without trial of American or Americans. Drone killing. By the way, the New York Times entitles this this story, "Show Us the Drone Memos." The senator from Kentucky wants to see, what did this supposed Supreme or court justice nominee, what did he advise the president when it comes to killing people without benefit of what was once called due process? Well, it turns out he wrote a brilliant legal justification for just executing anybody they want. Hey, no trial for you. Boom, boom, boom. What was it? Obama once said something about show me a predator. I don't remember, you know, here's a drone for you. I forget the quote, but basically it boiled down to, hey, you think there's a rule of law? Look out your window. Got a predator drone. Ha, 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 ha. Don't give me that Fourth Amendment thing. Don't give me that trial by jury thing. Don't give me that right to face your accuser, see the evidence against you, even have an indictment by a grand jury. No! One law for you and the stranger that dwells among you? Well, no. We'll kill you all with impunity. Unless you're part of Just Us. Now, here's the funny part. Again, the reason why Rand Paul is upset is, maybe he doesn't like this guy anyway, that's what I'm hoping here, but he also doesn't like the fact that the administration won't even cough up the opinions that this guy wrote. So they want these senators to advise and consent on approving this particularly nasty, evil servant of Satan to the court, and they will not cough up the legal opinions that he wrote saying, pardon my bluntness here, screw the Constitution and Bill of Rights, we're going to kill anybody we want. Here's my justification. You can't see it. You, the American people, aren't entitled to read what it is that this would-be justice is advising, allows them to kill you without even bothering with a pretense of a trial. And the Senate isn't allowed to see it either. How funny is that? Ha, ha, ha. Here's what Senator Paul said. People aren't allowed to understand the Obama administration's legal justification for this extraordinary exercise of so-called executive power. The White House may invoke national security against disclosure, but the legal arguments that affect the rights of every single American shouldn't have the privilege of secrecy, he believes. He says he agrees with the ACLU that, quote, no senator can meaningfully carry out his or her constitutional obligation to provide advice and consent on this nomination to a lifetime position as a federal appellate judge without being able to read Mr. Barron's most important and consequential legal writing. And the ACL goes on to point out that in modern history, presidential orders to kill Americans away from the battlefield are unprecedented. And, of course, he points out, too, hey, back when we had this thing called the Bill of Rights, it was clear. Fifth Amendment says that no one can be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Sixth Amendment talks about the accused enjoying a right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury, all kinds of other things, fundamental rights that are simply non-existent anymore in post-constitutional America. One law for you and the stranger that dwells among you? Not so much. We had this story earlier. I'm not going to go into the details because there are many, many, many like it. A court, in this case in Milwaukee, has said, a privileged communication between a woman and a so-called medical health practitioner is no longer privileged. That's not news. I mean, for crying out loud, they're tapping your phones and groping your gonads at public airports. What else is new? But They came and they, because she evidently had a practice of openly carrying handguns legally at a local church, outside a coffee shop and so forth, they came and they hauled her away, took her guns, of course, for an emergency medical examination, and a court this week, or what now passes for it, upheld the warrantless entry and seizure of her and her property. Remember, peons don't have rights. Former CIA director, I think you're seeing a pattern at this point here, former CIA director and National Security Agency, it was once called No Such Agency, but then we had Ed Snowden, a guy named Michael Hayden, Menachemo, was in front of Congress, and he admitted that, quote, we kill people based on metadata. Yeah, we're not supposed to have it. It ain't constitutional, but we'll kill you for it anyway. And finally, that brings me to this one. I think the point ought to be obvious. If it's not, this will do it. Boise, Idaho, a federal magistrate judge ruled this week on Tuesday that the Idaho ban, passed by a Democratic majority of the people of Idaho, saying that same-sex marriage is not to be permitted here, has been struck down as unconstitutional. Now, how funny is that? Here's the whopper line in this. U.S. District Magistrate Judge Candy Dale wrote in the decision that Idaho's laws banning same-sex marriage unconstitutionally deny gay and lesbian citizens their fundamental right to marry. Now, you catch the funniness here? They don't have a fundamental right to life. We can kill them with a drone. They don't have a fundamental right to be free of illegal search and seizure. You name it. They have only two fundamental rights, I guess. They can commit abomination before God if they've got a license from Big Brother to do something he says is not right. And, of course, if they happen to do it with a female as opposed to a male, they can kill the baby that results. That's the only kind of control a woman still has over her body. Isn't that funny? You have a right to your body. Now, we can rape it. We can deprive it of the ability to defend itself. We can grope you at a public airport. We can subject you to microwaves. We can inject you against your will. We can, of course, kill you. But you've got a right to commit murder. Don't you feel good? So here you are, folks. Let's talk about the First Amendment, right to freedom of assembly, of worship, free speech. The Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms that shall not be infringed. No, shall not be allowed. The Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth, Seventh, Eighth, Ninth, Tenth Amendments, none of that genuine print stuff applies. But you got a right, a fundamental right, to marry. And the word marry, of course, doesn't appear in the entire Constitution or Bill of Rights anywhere. So, rights to life, liberty, property, not so much. Right to things that God himself calls an abomination. Now we're talking. Can you see the pattern? Calling evil good and good evil? Yeah, that's part of it. One law for you and the stranger that dwells among you? Well, not so much. I'm going to take a deep breath. Because when I see the destruction of the rule of law, when I see things that are just abomination before God, sanctified and set apart, and made cherim, devoted to another master, I begin to say, how many times have we moved down the 7x7x7 road? Well, it's pretty tough not to argue that it's not at least, let's say, 50x7 or so down the line, 49x7, working our way towards the bottom. Second set of stories. Now, these are the stories, to my mind, that really kind of tell us a bit more, if you will. The first set, rule of law, well, again, remember, if we can be lied to for 1,700 years, that the law of God is done away with, nailed to the cross. Let God be true and every man a liar. Well, if we can believe that whopper, that the creator and author of Scripture and the universe, who says over and over again when he signs his commandments and statutes and judgments, Ani Yahuwah, and says, I change not. He's the same yesterday and today and tomorrow, is another way to put it. If he says that stuff and his law doesn't matter a whit, well, why would we think that pitiful laws of men, whether it's the Magna Carta or the Bill of Rights, would fare any better? Second set of news this week. Now, this came out earlier in the week. Speaking of people who are above the law, and I like the way Vox Day put it in posting his commentary on this particular story. One can honestly not call the U.S. a banana republic anymore. Of course, it's not a republic. It's more of a banana empire. And he points to a story out of the Ukraine, where the largest gas producer there, the largest private, public-private, I guess is the right way to put it, gas producer in the Ukraine, a company called Burisma Holdings, has expanded its board of directors. They have found it expedient to put on the board of directors the son of one of the co-emperors, Mr. VP Biden's son. R. Hunter Biden is now a new director. And again, I like, let's just cut to the chase. You know, forget all the propaganda that was spewed about how he's going to protect the people and do all kinds of good things to make the economy of Ukraine strong again. Daddy helps arrange for the overthrowing of the elected government. They put in their puppet state, and the grateful oligarchs put Junior in charge of the board of directors. Anyone remember when the Russians were the only really bad guys out there? Russia, for its part, as the sanctions have accelerated, is doing what everybody that I have admired for some time, that's had a pretty good track record of pointing out where we are on the race to the bottom, has been saying was inevitable, but it looks like they're accelerating the process. They call it de-dollarization, throwing the U.S. dollar off the cliff as the world reserve currency, the almighty dollar, in God we trust, different God, of course. And they held de-dollarization meetings this week and earlier, but they've accelerated of late. China and Iran, basically, this is the big deal. China and Russia getting together and saying, we're now going to conduct international trade in something other than dollars. Yuan, rubles, all that's fine. Maybe we'll put together a new world reserve currency. The BRICS nations slowly are signing up. And what Jim Willey, among others, are saying is, well, you will see this literally come down like a ton of bricks, because they can't afford to pull the plug on this one, pull the pin on the hand grenade, until it's all in place. But it's really, really close to being put in place. How will we know when it's coming? Just prior to the complete announcement that the U.S. dollar has been dethroned, and you see the shelves at Walmart empty and hamburger selling for $49 a pound. How will you know? Well, one of the things that I mentioned lately is look for certain specific nations, primarily Germany. More on Germany in a minute. To change its allegiance, switch allegiance, and come around to, the Axis, China, Russia. Similarly, Turkey, at the crossroads there, at the Bosporus. We saw a story this week about one of the other nations on his list, Saudi Arabia. Chuck Hagel, defense secretary, made an announcement yesterday. Didn't get a lot of press, essentially. I saw it in the London Telegraph, saying, hey, Middle East, you're on your own. We're cutting the military back. We got to spend all of our money to fight the next war, which will be domestic, right? We're not arming U.S. soldiers overseas anymore. They're not defending the borders. They're out maybe defending the empire, but not you all here in the Middle East. You're on your own. So it looks like the U.S. is cutting Saudi Arabia loose, among others, and that's part of the thing that Willie says, well, look for Saudi Arabia, too, to switch sides. So we got the dollarization meetings. Last story that came out literally yesterday as well, saying Russia and China are 98% of the way. They've been working on this for 10 years. They're 98% of the way there to exchanging the ability to do energy trades, particularly natural gas and LNG, liquefied natural gas, between the two countries. Primarily, it'll be Russia selling, China buying, of course, using an alternative currency. When it comes to the economic story that got some news, that at least in the alternative press, that made some waves this week, I'd say it's this one. By the way, I didn't ask this last night. Give me some ones. That way I know if I'm still online, too. Give me some ones if you heard about this story having to do with Dr. Paul Craig Roberts and or if I say the word Belgium associated with the Federal Reserve, if you know what I'm talking about. Give me ones if Belgium and the Federal Reserve clicks, and give me some twos if you're saying, I don't have a clue what he's referring to. It'll take a while, so I'll start into the story. The story I'm referring to is by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. He's former Assistant Treasury Secretary, and a fellow named Dave Kranzler. It appeared a number of places and literally had legs on the web, is the way they put it, called The Fed is the Great Deceiver. I have referred for months now to the vapor taper, which is claim that the Fed is tapering, but not really. They said that they were printing 85 billion new fiat dollars each and every month to buy their fake bonds. And then they said, well, things are so good, we're only going to cut that back, 10 billion bucks a month. So not 85, just 75, then 65, and then even less. Turns out, of course, it's a lie. And that's what Paul Craig Roberts revealed along with his co-author this week. From November 2013 through January of this year, Belgium, little teeny Belgium, purchased almost in 30% of its entire GDP in the form of U.S. Treasury bonds. Now, here's a company that doesn't have a trade surplus. What? Here's, well, both. Here's a company, here's a country that does not have a much of a budget surplus. They weren't running a trade surplus of any amount. No, their trade accounts and current accounts are all in deficit. Where'd they come up with this money? Where'd they get $140-plus billion worth of euros to buy U.S. fiat paper, treasury bonds and notes? Only one source, they say. Now, this is one of those interesting, can you spot the lie and follow the money kinds of trails? Only one source. The money came from the U.S. Federal Reserve, says the former Assistant Treasury Secretary. The purchase was laundered through Belgium. If you tried to do this with a gun, Big Brother calls it a federal crime. Straw purchaser. In order to hide the fact that Federal Reserve bond purchases during that same time frame, when Bernanke and then later Janet Yellen claimed there was tapering going on, were in fact not $85 billion, not $75 billion, not $65 billion, no, they were $112 billion a month. Huh? Would they lie? In other words, during those 3 months, there was a sharp rise, not a tapering, in bond purchases by the Fed. The Fed's actual bond purchases, say these authors, for those 3 months are $27 billion a month above the original $85 billion pre-taper monthly purchase. And, you know, successively higher among the later lying claims. Why did the Fed have to purchase so many bonds secretly? Answer. Well, we don't have the whole answer. Some country or countries, unknown at this time, for reasons that we don't know, although some informed speculation might suggest maybe one of the names would begin with an R, dumped $104 billion in treasuries in just 1 week. Okay. And, of course, he points out what I talk about all the time. Washington's power rests on the dollar being the world reserve currency. And if the world reserve currency falls out of favor, things get really ugly in the United States. Hey, maybe that's why they got the Department of Agriculture and the Bureau of Land Management and the FBI and the ATF and everybody else with three letters in their name buying more guns and bullets than any free country in the history of the world has ever conceived of. Just maybe. Russia. This is this week, a couple days later, has dumped 20% of its treasury holdings. Hey, maybe we begin to know who the mystery country is. Maybe there's others, too. They've dumped 20% of their entire treasury holdings as the mystery buyer, Belgium, bought another $40 billion on top of what the two authors were talking about earlier this week. So tiny Belgium now supposedly is the number three holder of U.S. fiat paper. Here's the summary from Zero Hedge. In summary, someone, not clear who, operating through Belgium, maybe a company called Euroclear, that's an interesting combination, Euroclear, and most likely the Euroclear service, and that's unconfirmed but possible, has added a record $141 billion in treasuries since December, or the month in which Bernanke announced the start of the vapor taper. And that host total now amounts to an unprecedented, not just $300, but $341 billion. They bought another $40 billion last month. And in sum now, too, the total their total treasury holdings amount to half of their total GDP. We're not done yet. Here's the other story that I think is unreported, well, at least unremarked anyway, by the waste stream. I've talked for a long time about how do you cover up a massive fraud on this scale? How do you keep the world's reserve currency, the world's reserve currency, in a land of, well, no real currency, no real money, no kasef, no gold, no silver for any of the currencies in the world anywhere? Now, that's not to say that Russia and China won't try that and that they aren't fixing to announce that. But for now, at least, there is no alternative to the fiat dollar that's not fully fiat, too. Well, one of the things you have to do is, of course, you have to keep a lid on the barometers, any indicators that might tell people just how badly they're being robbed. And if you can lie enough, and if you can keep the inflation exported from the United States and, you know, get poor little BRICS countries to have to take it on the chin, and their food prices go up, and their people starve, and they can't afford stuff. But in the meanwhile, at least so long as the gravy train keeps flowing, you can keep the generally dumbed down American public thinking all is right with the world, and there's a recovery in the works. Well, it involves this manipulation of gold and silver markets. And there have been a couple of cracks over the last year or so. I alluded to Germany, which may decide to switch sides here pretty soon. One of the things that seems to have kind of helped them to wake up and smell the coffee was people were asking the question, where's our gold? Deutsche Bank, the U.S. Fed's equivalent there in Germany. Deutsche Bank thought they had a bunch of gold on deposit with the Fed in New York and other places, and in France and in other places. And they began to worry, maybe it's not there. Maybe we better go look and see if it's there. Hey, maybe we better just tell them we'd like it back. So they did. And the Fed said, you can't have it. Remember that song? I want it, from Tommy, I think. You can't have it. Well, we'll give it to you. It's going to take 7 years. No, we lied. It's going to take 20. So now Deutsche Bank is in trouble with the German people in particular, and some of the German regulators are upset. Here's the story that came out this week. Following a crackdown on precious metals manipulation by various European regulators, mostly in Germany, which led to the shocking outcome that some time ago Deutsche Bank said, you know, we're not going to play in the crooked casinos anymore. At least we're not going to publicly participate in the London Gold and Silver Market Fixing Committees. These are huge, too big to fail and too big to jail international banksters that literally participate in fixing, manipulating the price on a daily basis. They get together in a big smoke-filled room. Zero Hedge even has a picture of it. At the Rothschild facilities. And they decide what we're going to claim gold and silver are worth today. So they pulled out of that. So here's what happened this week. The shocking outcome is that the London Silver Market Fixing Company ended up in a most curious predicament. It would have only two member banks that are still left. HSBC Bank and the Bank of Nova Scotia. And as an even more shocking result this week, they were forced to announce that after August 14, 2014, basically 3 months hence, they will no longer exist. And some are calling this the first of a number of upcoming victories for those who believe in and have fought for fair and unmanipulated precious metals markets. Press release just basically says the exact same thing. They have the usual caveats, for personal reasons, we're not going to play in this. No, that's not the truth at all, basically. They say that this three-month period that they're giving themselves will provide the opportunity for a market-led adjustment, like we're going to let the market lead now? Give me a break. With consultation between clients and those who they have shafted. No, that's not what it says either, but market participants is what they call those people who have been shafted. And here's what my comment is. You know, don't you, that before this announcement was made, they've already got Plan B ready to uncork. Why a three-month period? Well, individual members may resign on 7 clear days of notice, but we wanted to make sure there was plenty of time for this adjustment to take place. And they're not going to comment on how contracts are going to be settled. Well, we're just going to... The company does not comment on such things. What does this mean for the other crooked fixing companies, like for the gold and silver and platinum and palladium markets? Silver we know about, but this relates only to silver, it says. The company is not in a position to comment on other fixings. What we're talking about here, basically, folks, are some of the mile markers that would tell us just how big this wave is and where we might be in the 7x7x7 stuff. I already did the story about the oil-rich Gulf states now can no longer be guaranteed security by the United States. I guess if you want security in the Mideast, Saudi Arabia better turn to Russia, along with Germany and Turkey and the BRICS. All right. I'm going to pause. Did I see any questions or not? Did I not see any questions that scrolled off the screen? Okay, I don't think so. I've got a whole stack of stories here. I'm not going to mess with them today unless there are questions or unless it seems appropriate. Story after story after story, making points that are pretty well clear. The police state is the federal alternative. It's been literally worked up to for a long, long time. I've alluded to the Department of Agriculture buying, oh, as it turns out, not just submachine guns, and the DHS, not just billions of rounds of ammo, enough for several rounds to the head for every man, woman, and child in America. No, DOA, so many three-letter acronyms, has announced, too, that they've submitted requests. They want to buy armor and ballistic vests as well, because they haven't gotten all the guns out of the hands of all the peons yet, I guess. They seem to be concerned. People were implying, I saw some comments online earlier, why do you think they want all these guns? What is the purpose? Well, by the way, it's not even the Department of Forestry that is getting the guns, evidently. What's the reason? Well, you know, when you're buying weapons and especially ammunition, hollow points, in the case of DHS, that are outlawed by the Geneva Convention for use in war, there's only one other alternative. Hey, maybe it's those people that don't deserve the right to life that a federal judge is going to say, we can kill you with impunity, and we're not even going to tell you what our rationale is for doing it, much less for claiming you don't have a right to due process. Ha, 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 you peons. You think we can infringe your right to keep and bear arms? For crying out loud, we've got everything else. That's the last one that's keeping us from doing what we're fixing to do. I don't think there's too much, you know, you almost have to be blind not to connect the obvious dots. It's like one of those, you know, coloring books for three-year-olds. The dots are about the size of an orange, and the three-year-old says, oh, that might have to go here. Here's another dot that won't be connected. I throw this out just because we need a little comic relief at this point. This is from Michael Snyder. I like Michael Snyder. He's a good, solid evangelical kind of Christian. I don't know that he sees the humor in his own piece here, really. But this article came out about 2 days ago. It says, the meat crisis is here. The price of shrimp is up 61%, and we got 7 million dead pigs to deal with. Yes, now he calls it meat. I'm going to put the word sick there because we know what the Bible is referring to as food or meat. Sometimes different words have different connotations in different contexts. And the connotation when it comes to shrimp and pigs is that they're not food, if you read Scripture. That's the thing that mostly gets overlooked by people who are, you know, dead set on following the 7 times 7 times 7 thing to its logical conclusion. But what to my mind was interesting here is perhaps without recognizing it, Snyder has literally nailed the fact that the creator of the universe, remember in this portion this week, he says, look, if you won't listen to me, it'll get 7 times worse. If you won't listen to me, I'll warn you. I'm telling you now, it'll get 7 times worse. If you still won't listen, if you walk contrary to me, if you keep eating stuff that I'm telling you is poison, for crying out loud, it's going to get 7 times worse. Well, how many 7 times 7s are we up to? Leading the way, in the huge increase in food prices, meat in the United States overall has risen at the fastest pace in more than 10 years last month. Leading the way is price of shrimp. The Bureau of Lying Statistics says the shrimp prices have increased an astonishing 61% year over year. Pork, too, is moving upward at warp factor speeds thanks to a disease. It's called porcine epidemic diarrhea virus, doesn't that sound appetizing, which has already killed 10% of all the pigs in the entire United States. 7 million pigs dead so far. In the case of shrimp, it affects lots and lots and lots of farming operations in the Asian area, Southeast Asia in particular. It's called early mortality syndrome, and Bloomberg says that the ailment supposedly has, well, I'll put it this way, it has no known effect on humans, but the article says that it kills approximately 9 out of every 10 infected shrimp that come down with it. They also blame the drought in California, the fire, and of course this week we found out that the whole San Diego area is evidently on fire. Again, the drought is supposedly the problem, but also, there were stories I saw that said that the California Police Department are saying 8 of the 9 fires seem to have been suspicious in origin. And a internet media source, some of you have heard of, a guy calls himself Hawk, is claiming, and I'll look for a second witness on this, haven't seen it yet, but I think it's an interesting speculation, I'll call it at this point, that it's Spetsnaz, Russian Special Forces troop, that were involved in setting those fires. Can't imagine why Spetsnaz would be wanting to set fires in the United States. but just maybe there's a reason. I promised last week that one of the things that I would talk about this week is the word without prejudice. Without prejudice. Now, some of you are thinking, did he just switch gears? Did we just do what we used to joke about when I was in college? Is that a Tasmanian downshift? Hopefully not. Because, of course, one of the things that I'll talk about all the time is, well, if we recognize that we're on this downward slope of this huge tidal wave, you know, if you're standing on a beach and all of a sudden the complete ocean disappears in front of you, gets sucked out to sea, maybe it's time to head for higher ground. People in Banda Aceh found that out several years ago. Same thing is true in Scripture. There's a time, as Solomon says, there's a time to reap, a time to sow, a time for war, a time for peace. There's time for all kinds of things. There's also a time to come out of her, literally, separate ourselves. And frequently I'll talk about that in any number of different fora, how to do it economically, physically, obviously, spiritually. Come out of the 501c3, Caesar-created, state-based and state-chartered corporate faith-based institutions of another god. Why? Well, because they clearly serve another master. The IRS will tell you, hey, you preach certain verses that I've talked about already today, that's politically incorrect. You lose your tax deduction. More stories came out this week about how not only was the IRS crackdown on state-blessed 501c3 corporations, well, or at least those that wanted Caesar's blessing, not only was it not coming from little teeny places in Ohio, it came directed from the IRS's central offices right there in the Washington, D.C. area. Amazing. Who'd have thought it? Came from the top. One law? No, not one law. By the way, if you're looking for the one law reference, I've got it written down here on my notes. You'll see it in multiple places. Leviticus 24:22, most recent Torah portion. We just talked about it. But it also shows up in Exodus chapter 12, verse 49, and in Numbers. This one's easy to remember. Numbers 15:16. And it's also in verse 29 with a slightly different implication. I'm going to skip over some of these articles and just mention more other things by way of outlining why it is that without prejudice matters. Now, here's the question that leads us to this discussion. Okay, Mark, let's and I've heard this question 100 different times in 100 different ways. Probably somebody will be thinking it this morning. How do we do this? Do we have to physically leave? Is that enough? Remember, if you physically leave the United States, Big Brother will claim we can still drone you anywhere in the world. You don't have to be a U.S. citizen. We will kill Iranians and Islamic groups that aren't connected with our own Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram. As it turns out, that might be a CIA front group too. Who knows? They're not coming public with the information on that connection any more than they are with this particular Harvard professor's deciding that he can kill you with impunity and justify it, but you can't read why. No, those things are all hidden. How do we do it? What do we come out? It's not enough physically, okay? Well, we understand the spiritual stuff. That some folks will say that's the easy one. I'm going to suggest it's harder than you'd think, for the simple reason that, well, like we just read in this week's Haftorah portion, Jeremiah 16:19, we've inherited lies from our fathers. It is not easy to shed the baggage that we're carrying from ex-Christianity, right? Law is done away with. I know people that have been talking for years. Oh, I'm coming out of all that stuff, legalism. But then they'll still... Oh, that's legalism. In other words, the little twinges are still there. Somebody calls you a racist. Somebody calls you a domestic terrorist. Somebody calls you any of the pejorative words that, it's okay for some people to use, but not others, right? You know the story. There are certain people who can use racial epithets with impunity and not worry about it. There are other people who can't even say the words, but they still get accused of being racists. There are certain people who can carry a copy of the Constitution and get away with it. There are other people who, if they have a copy of the Constitution, will be called domestic terrorists. And literally, I can show you case after case after case of people being indicted because they had a copy of the Constitution. Terrorist literature. I kid you not. I wish that was a joke, but it's not. It's the law and the rule of law that has become the joke. Here's another one. Well, no, we'll come back to these. We'll use these to introduce once I get the point of why this without prejudice thing matters. So it's not easy to come out spiritually. I can't tell you how many times I hear people say, oh, well, you know, I understand. You know, we need to keep Sabbath. And I understand that we need to keep the feasts. And I understand that what God says about marriage is important. But I'm not hearing that in my church. I might not be being fed in my Sunday church. But hey, you know, the kids like it there. They got friends there. They got a basketball court. I can remember my own family. And this pains me to say, but it's part of my own sordid past. When we were moving to a new town, and Dad had said, well, we need to find a church that's got a great gym. You know, it has nice facilities with basketball courts and all. And that's the key. Well, ultimately, I guess, you know, in defense of the family position there, what the heck, right? They're all teaching the same crap. They're all teaching the same spiritual poison about Sun God Day and Ishtar and all that stuff. What difference does it make otherwise? Yeah, find the one with a good basketball court, for crying out loud. No, in other words, we've inherited lies from our fathers. We didn't even realize that none of those churches, I mean, literally not one of the churches that was even on the list for consideration while I was a kid growing up, had a single piece of the important stuff right, in hindsight. So there's a lot of baggage there. It takes a while to root all of that out. Economically, here comes the real rub. Even if you leave the United States physically and think that, well, the drones, well, yeah, the drones can come here. CIA, oh, yeah, they're operating here. Can a United States government buy a Costa Rican government? You betcha. Can they buy, Costa Rica's better than lots of them. Can they buy the banana republics? Absolutely. Oh, they're losing out now with the BRICS nations and even bigger ones like Germany and Turkey saying, we've had it with your fiat dollar and we've decided that we don't like the strings that come attached. Maybe we'll go with the evil empire of the Soviets because they may be really nasty and evil and bad, but they can't be any worse. How do you do it? Can you physically stay in the United States and count on the protection of the Creator? Well, he says so. He says he can regather us from wherever we are, from scattered all over the place. He can protect us. He can hide us. There are some caveats. We need to be walking in obedience. Now, are they absolute firm guarantees? I can't honestly claim that they are. We need to walk in faith. That's the key. Understand that he is who he says he is. I'm gonna walk as if I believed those promises, because I do. Because I think that that's really the only protection you've got. Will my gold and my guns and my other stuff save me if I'm not walking in obedience? Let me be as blunt as I can. Hell no. If you're living in a hell on earth and you're not following the right master, well, guess where you still are? So how do we come out as best we can and still deal with things that people will say, well, yeah, I get paid. My pay comes in terms of U.S. fiat dollars. I can't avoid that. I have to file my taxes and declare myself to be a good little taxpayer and therefore a slave of the state, right? Everybody knows if you claim to be a taxpayer or a U.S. citizen, well, by agreement, you've entered into this contract and says you don't have those God-given rights. Those do not apply to peons, to serfs, to slaves, to U.S. citizens, to taxpayers, to those who have entered into agreement and traded essential liberty, as Franklin warned against, for a little temporary security, or, as the Bible warns against, their birthright for a cup of pottage. Is it possible to be in the world and not of the world is another way, I guess, to put it. Is there a silver bullet? Well, let's answer that one right off the top. No, there's not. There's no magic words that you can say where all of a sudden the beast will say, oh, that one. Now, are there some things we can do and then be known by our fruits? Where whether the beast admits it or not, the beast might just choose to go elsewhere? Can we be hidden? Why does the Bible use that terminology? I think the answer is all of the above. What is it that the promise was made in this week's portion that I have alluded to and said I'd come back? This idea of peace. They'll cry peace and safety, but don't believe it. I'll scatter you among the nations, he says. What about this concept of peace and of a sword that won't come upon the land at some point? Yeah, we're not talking about now. We're not talking about a place in the land. But friendly fire. That was the concept of friendly fire. Is it just possible that our Creator can protect us in ways we might not have thought about? I'm going to say this again. I will periodically, more and more late, it seems, I'll make this point. We know, every time you make a phone call, every time you send an email, every time you post on Facebook or send a tweet or make an international call, or when your phone is just sitting there and maybe you're making love with your spouse, can Big Brother turn it on and listen or video? You bet. By the way, don't keep a laptop in the vicinity of your bedroom open is a good thing to do. Can they be watching you and listening to you? You know they are. Orwell warned them, warned us. Big Brother is watching. So what? Can we have some protection in spite of that? And are there people listening now? You bet. Right? So I'm addressing this next couple of comments to the people who are listening now that shouldn't be, unless they intend to be listening because they want to serve Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. There are people who are listening to this because they're getting paid, in other words, to listen to things that domestic terrorists or other verboten types. They've even got some new names, and I skipped over that article, but I got this piece from Andrew P. Napolitano, a former federal judge, talking about... Nope, it's not that one. It's a different one. Anyway, so many stories about the police state, so little time. The artful use of words and how the NSA and others has got some new names to describe people just like us, people that don't believe in their God. You who are listening, do I really believe you serve a different God? Well, did you put your hand on the Bible and swear to protect and preserve and defend the Constitution? Did you know what that meant when you did it? Do you know that there are people out here who serve Yod-Heh Vav-Heh and Him alone? Are you making war against them? Are you a whore? Are you getting paid to do something that you vowed, whether you didn't completely understand what you were vowing to or not, that now you know better? Well, as I've said before, you don't have to deal with me. You have to deal with the Creator, the real God, the one who will eventually call you to task. That's what I want people to think about. Oh, that brings us back to friendly fire. Because, see, I firmly believe that there are going to be more and more people, just like this portion is telling us, among the remnant, who start to wake up and say, you know what, I better examine what I believe. I better examine whom I'm serving. I better ask, is it really the Creator of the universe? Or am I keeping a different set of feasts and serving a different God? It's increasingly obvious. As the 7x7 chastening builds, more and more people are going to have to say, am I going to wake up and see what's so clear? Things that he calls abomination? Is that how I'm drawing my daily bread? Who am I counting on? Oh, am I making flesh my arm? Am I trusting in man rather than him? Oh, now we're really starting to get to it. So, yeah, I think there are two kinds of people listening today. In other words, people who are here because they genuinely seek to serve Yah and they want to let iron sharpen iron and they'd like to hear the truth and they'd like to be able to say, okay, be like the Bereans. Go search it out. Don't believe me, folks. You know that. Search out the scriptures for yourself. See if the things we're saying are true. See if you connect the dots the same way. And then there are other people who are looking for something they can say, oh, this is a rationale to kill somebody. Well, you don't need a rationale to kill me. You really don't. You've got your judge, nominee of your emperor, who says we don't need no stinking due process at all. What do I care if Big Brother's listening and is building a case against me? They don't even need a case. They don't need evidence. They can make it up out of whole cloth, just like they make up the law. Do you see the point? When there is no law at all, what difference does the evidence make? Oh, well, it makes one difference and one difference only. If you're going to kill somebody first and then demonize them once they can't speak back, once they've already been silenced, so that you can either scare or coerce or dupe other people, well, then it matters. That's what we're talking about. And in all of those cases, folks, it boils down to the same thing. Either you trust in Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and Him alone, or you don't. So that's what I'm asking all of those that are listening and that are being paid by another master. Where do you put your trust? It comes down to helping to explain why this without prejudice thing is important. Now, I'm not working up to it quite yet. What we're talking about are some words that you can put on a signature line. How many times this morning have I mentioned that the creator of the universe, when he says, these are my statutes and my judgments, do this, Ani Yahuwah. Or sometimes it's Ani Yahuwah Elohechem, I am the Lord, your God. He signs it. Well, we're told, among other things, that we should be able to be judged by our fruits. Are you walking the walk, is the old Christian way of putting it. Are you just talking the talk? Well, sometimes people are talking the talk, and it turns out if you read it, they ain't reading the same talk. They're talking the talk that's got nothing to do with what's actually written. Any more than people that claim that they're obeying the Constitution have ever read it. So what without prejudice is, as we describe, how is it that we can be in the world but not of the world? How is it that we can deal in a world where there's so much corruption, so much lack of law, and literally everything that we touch is corrupted and tainted and nasty? I get paid in dollars, Mark, what do? How can I come out? IRS takes it right out of my check before I see it. I'm supporting abortions. I'm supporting gay marriage. I'm supporting fill in the blank with the abomination, the fake money system. Everything that God says not to do, I can't help it. They're stealing it from me right off the top. Well, the key word there is I can't help it. What can I help? I can proclaim that I'm withdrawing my consent. That's the way the founders put it in the Declaration of Independence. Remember that? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator, capitalized. That's not the creator of the 501c3 church. It's a different one. With certain unalienable rights, among these are life, liberty, and property, or the pursuit of happiness, and that to secure these rights, here comes the point I'm heading to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Are we consenting? Are we saying, this government, this killing, raping, murdering, abomination-promoting, anti-God government comes in my name? My response? My dad used to put it this way. My answer is not just no, it's hell no! I will not remain quiet. We've talked about this one too. You do not stand idly by, silent, watching over the blood of your brother. You speak up. Well, they'll kill me. They're going to kill you anyway if you're scared of that other God. We are to speak up. We're to blow the shofar. We're to warn people there's a sword coming upon the land. For crying out loud, open your eyes and look. 7 times 7 ain't enough for you yet. How many times worse does it have to get before you finally start saying, you know, a whole hell of a lot of people here. I'm using that word hell a lot because what we're creating, you know, I may not believe in the Christian interpretation of the hell, but I do see a hell on earth, and it looks a hell of a lot like what it is people are scared of going to when they die. Well, they don't have to die to find it. They're going to see it right here. Come out of her. Separate yourself. Withdraw consent. The other word is choice of law. Yeah, by my fruit, they might be able to see. Well, we got people that are come. They're going to come and they're going to do exactly what they did in Stasi East Germany and in Stalin's Russia and in Adolf Hitler's ghettos. They're going to take people away and they're going to kill them and they're going to execute them and they're going to say they don't have rights and they don't have right to. They're already saying all this stuff. And they got electronic technology that Stalin and Hitler never dreamed of to do it. We're to speak His truth boldly as we ought to. We're to demonstrate by our fruit who we serve. We're to proclaim who we serve. We're not to keep silent over the blood of our brothers, over the injustice that's being done in the land. We're to proclaim that there is one law for us and the stranger that dwells among us. We're to keep His commandments, His judgments, His statutes. We're to honor His Sabbaths and His feasts. And we're to do all these things in spite of the fact that people are going to hate us for it. Just like they've hated people throughout history that have done similar things. And if we don't do that, we got lots of bigger problems to worry about. Seriously. Who are we devoted to? Harem. Are we devoted to Him? Pledging ourselves to Him by a vow? Or are we devoted to the accursed? Under the ban? Part of the accursed city? The accursed land? And how do we make it clear? Now, again, people aren't always going to watch. I'm reminded of this, this idea of the pig. The pig being, according to, the oral tradition, the pig is the most unclean of all the animals. Why? Because he's a deceptive little son of a gun. Okay? You can look at lots of other animals, like rabbits, and you can say, hey, they don't have a split hoof. Horses, they don't have a split hoof. Dogs don't have a split hoof. They ain't clean. Don't eat them. People, by the way. Not clean. Don't eat them. They don't have a split hoof. How about piggies? Oh, they got a split hoof. Let's eat them. Wait a minute. Not so fast. Check and see if it chews the cud. How do you do that? Well, you got to watch his fruit. You got to watch his action. You got to spend some time looking at this little critter. He's a deceptive son of a gun. That's essentially the argument that the rabbis will use, in other words, for claiming pigs are really unclean, because they look clean, but they're not. And by the way, that's also the case for men. That's why I call certain men pigs, because they look clean. I remember a certain president had his big black Bible. You knew that that meant that there was another bimbo eruption coming. I did not have sex with that woman, Monica Lewinsky. And if the big black Bible is out, he looks clean. It's important. They all pay lip service, in other words. Got to look clean, even if you're lying. And so, pig is appropriate. We need to be able to say, okay, how do I look clean? And by the way, my walk had better bear it out so that I'm not deceptive like the pig. That's important. But there is a way, at least, that we can sign documents and, if you will, reserve our rights and indicate, in a sense, that even the police state claims to understand, says, I have reserved my rights. Isn't that cool? Is it a magic bullet? No. Because we got to a point now where the U.S. government says we don't have a right to face your accuser. We're not going to give you your day in court. None of that matters. We're just going to kill people. Okay? So what I'm talking about, I'll sometimes refer to things that are necessary but not sufficient conditions. Right? Talking about pigs again. It is a necessary but not sufficient condition that an animal that be meat or food does not one but both things. Has a split hoof and chews the cud. It's got a split hoof. Necessary, but not sufficient. Must chew the cud too. How about writing without prejudice above your signature? Is it necessary? Well, no. It turns out there's actually other ways to demonstrate that too. But this is a good one. It's an easy one. So it's not so much a necessary but not sufficient condition. It's an indicator. If it was a silver bullet, right, might be a necessary condition. But again, there is no silver bullet in a lawless land. Let's talk about I've got some examples from the news that'll help to make this point. Well, we'll do this backwards tonight. We'll do them in the other order. If I talked about the Uniform Commercial Code, I'm going to ask this with some ones. Do people know what the Uniform Commercial Code is? Give me a one if you think you know. A two if you say, well, maybe I've heard of it. But no, I really don't know what the Uniform Commercial Code is. Tell me about that. So one if you know about the Uniform Commercial Code and say, yep, I'm pretty familiar with that legally. Two if you don't. And don't worry about it. I'm going to tell about it anyway. But this will probably affect a little bit about how much detail I go into. By the way, while people are putting the ones and twos on the screen, disclaimer applies because I know folks listen to this via the podcast or later on. And if you want, you got questions, I always appreciate the feedback. You can do that at mark@marknywatt.com. Mark, M-A-R-K, @marknywatt.com. And we'll try to answer other questions later. Looks like mostly twos. All right. When I was in high school, let's just say it was a while ago, I took a class in business law, and we talked about the common law. Now, in those days, the Uniform Commercial Code, unfortunately, was already in existence. But there were still a few people that actually thought the common law ought to matter. And by the way, if you go to the Constitution, you'll find references to the common law in suits at common laws, in the Bill of Rights, and other things. So the common law, at least once upon a time, was, well, supposed to be based on the common law of England. There was something called Blackstone's Commentaries, one of the most important, after Deuteronomy, of the books that were referenced by the Founding Fathers and the Committees of Correspondence. The common law, in other words, was based on Deuteronomy, and it was based on precedent and on a number of cases, stare decisis, already decided, that had been decided for literally hundreds of years. And people said, okay, here's certain things we know. And here's at least one of those things I'll give as an example that comes right out of Scripture. Contract. Well, we know that the concept of contract is described in Scripture. We see people making covenants, too. That's a little bit kind of a more severe, more strict thing even than compact or contract might be. Make no treaty with the inhabitants of the land. There's another indication. Well, anyway, what the common law said over hundreds of years, came from Great Britain over to the colonies, then to America, is that there are certain things we know to be true. And one of those is, what are the elements of a contract? And when I took business law in high school, there were five elements of a contract. And it had to do with offer and acceptance. And it had to be legal. And there couldn't be fraud involved or duress. So those are the elements of a contract. In other words, if I say, I will offer to sell you my car, and you will give me $500 of silver coin, it's a lawful contract. If there is offer and acceptance, and the car is mine, and I'm not putting a gun to your head and saying, you will buy this car or I will kill you, or you will sign this under penalty of perjury, or I'll come and take your house. Okay, those would all be lawful contracts because they had these elements of contract. So this is the kind of thing that the common law essentially said. And the Constitution and the various constitutions of the several states, as they entered into the federal union, made it clear that the common law was part of our law. It was incorporated kind of by assumption. It was assumed into the system of law. We don't have to outline all of it. We just reference the common law in the document, the Constitution and Bill of Rights, and we know what it means. Well, along comes a time when, after the complete Stasiization of America, I guess, I'm looking particularly at 1933 under Roosevelt, the various emergency acts, the 1913, prior to that, the time frame when we got rid of lawful money, at least started the process, incorporated the Federal Reserve, public-private partnership, added to it the enforcement arm, its IRS. In 1933, we, under the guise of an emergency, the Emergency Banking Relief Act, March the 9th, 1933, we got this emergency, it's equivalent to war. Going to do things that might not be quite constitutional, but hey, you know, the ends justify the means. It's expedient. Later on, Roosevelt took all the people's gold. Years later, 1964 was the last year when there was actual silver, kasef, honest money, in general circulation. It disappeared real quickly once the mint started producing pot metal coins. That's called Gresham's Law. So you can look at this progression of how we went down this path to the point where pretty soon, I think it was in the 1950s, they said, well, we need to get rid of any remnants of this common law thing. Because, you know, the common law talks about silver coin. It talks about various things, you know, in disputes at common law of more than $20. People have a right to a trial by jury. Oh, we don't like that. Got to get rid of it. If we're going to consolidate our power and basically replace all of the law of the United States. Now, were all the people that were involved in this process evil? No, they just didn't know what they were doing. They were getting duped. That's never happened before, has it? In other words, literally what happened was, and this is where I will start a lot of times in talking about it today. By agreement, people were moved from being citizens, with a capital C, as the Constitution once referred to them, who had God-given rights, like the right to freedom of assembly, of speech, of worship, to be free of illegal search and seizure, to keep and bear arms, all that good old stuff that doesn't apply anymore. Oh, by the way, also to life, liberty, and property. That doesn't apply anymore either. They were moved into this different category. Slaves, literally. There are other words that you'll find used in law as well. They were literally, they gave their power of attorney to the state. They said, we will serve, not Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, we'll serve this other master. Our church, by the way, is going to tell us how wonderful this is. It's the Romans 13 church, too, 501c3. When God says jump, and we're not talking about the Bible God. No, we're talking about your Lord in Washington. When he says jump, you say, yes, sir, how high? He says turn in your guns, you say, oh, yes, any good slave of the state knows. That's what I will do. They moved, in other words, from this place where people made a choice of law that was different from the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and they moved into this system of private law. How'd they do it? By agreement. By contract. It was a perfectly legitimate contract. Yeah, it did involve fraud, but if you look at Scripture, you'll find out that fraud, unlike in common law, does not vitiate a contract. I'm referring to the time after the Battle of Ai, when the Gibeonites came to Joshua. Joshua had been told, make no treaty with the inhabitants of the land. The Gibeonites had a pretty good story, though. Oh, look at us. Been on the road a long time, right? Old sandals, old wineskins. We're a poor, sorry lot here. We want to make a treaty with you. Don't kill us. Just let us live. We'll even be your servants. They were lying. It was fraud. We would be saying that under the common law, fraud vitiates contract. That contract is dissolvable. God said, nuh-uh. I warned you. I told you not to do this. You did it anyway. I'm going to hold you to the terms. When we make vows in Scripture, as this portion and as many other portions, like Numbers 30, indicate, we are held to the terms of the contract. Now, there are occasions when he'll come out and say, okay, I'm going to get you out of bondage. We need to pray about that. You can be redeemed. We saw that in this week's portion. People can make vows, and there can be redemption. You add a fifth part to it. How does it work? Well, sometimes it ain't easy. And certainly this particular master doesn't want to let you go. He lied to you fair and square. You got to deal with the devil. I want your soul, essentially, is the old story, right, from Faust and others. So what's happened, whether people like it or not, and we've got this history. It started in, well, started probably before the Civil War, and then it ended up with the 1870s. There was some interesting stuff people can point to there. 1913, big date, the war to make the world safe for democracy. Weren't supposed to be one of those. Then 1933, and then fascism came to America, and then we have 1964 and 1972, when Tricky Dick said we're not even going to honor gold contracts to foreign banks, and so forth and so on. Well, here we are today, when the vestiges of the common law are completely gone. I was describing the Uniform Commercial Code. Well, the Uniform Commercial Code is what replaced, for all practical purposes, the common law, and says you can now contract into this whole different set of law commercially. Oh, buying or selling. No one will buy or sell without a mark. Isn't it cool? We've got all the pieces in place as a result of the Uniform Commercial Code. Now, there's another thing that you'll find in the common law, and that is that if the common law says that fraud vitiates a contract, in other words, if you're lied to, okay, I will offer to sell you this car. You will offer me the money to buy it, real money. And we make the deal. And I told you that this car only had 23,000 miles on it. And then you find out, no, it had 323,000 miles. And the differential's been packed full of sawdust. And there's oil that hasn't been in there for months, and it's been replaced with, you know, old cooking grease. Well, guess what? I'm going to go back and I'm going to say, you know, you lied to me. I don't want this car because it's not what was represented. There was an implied warranty of fitness for purpose, other kinds of things that would also be in the common law. Take it back. And if you don't like that, well, at least once upon a time, I could take you to court. And the court would say, hey, it's an invalid contract. You pay him his money back. But things are a little bit different today because we got the common law instead, replaced by the Uniform Commercial Code. But again, one of the elements that was always there was if there is fraud, then there's supposed to be a way out. Oh, and there's also supposed to be what's called remedy in the law. You give people a choice. There needs to be a remedy. There needs to be a way for them to find satisfaction if things don't turn out as planned. Now, what we're finding, of course, in the United States today, and indeed the rest of the world, is all of that's being done away with. Again, slaves don't have rights. Slaves don't have the right, so far as Big Brother's concerned, to say no. They don't even have the right to face their accuser again or enter into due process anymore. Turns out that in the Uniform Commercial Code, there's a way out. Now, what's funny about this is it's been hidden. And if you go look online, Go check this out. You can do a search for Uniform Commercial Code or just UCC. You'll find places like one of the reference sites was Cornell Law Library. You can find online listings of this. And years ago, when I first learned about this stuff, it was UCC Section 1-207 that mattered. UCC 1-207. Now, I mention that because you might still find that in some of the searches online, but don't worry about those numbers. Because as another one that I found pointed out, it's been changed. It's been moved. Got to hide it from people because people were finding out about it. So, UCC 1-207 has been changed. It's been moved. It's now UCC 1-308 to hide it from the public. What the heck are we talking about here? What it says is this. I'll read it. This is UCC 1-308, Part 3, Performance or Acceptance under Reservation of Rights is what the section is called. Performance or acceptance under reservation of rights. What are we talking about, Mark? This sounds like so much legalism. Well, it is, folks. Here's how it works. You want anything today. I mean anything. You want to drive a car. You need a driver's license. You want to travel. Well, you need a passport. You got to sign your IRS form pledging your life under penalty of perjury, saying, oh, I'm waiving my Fifth Amendment rights. Got to sign it. Now, by the way, the IRS doesn't like this because they know what this means. And they're going to tell you slaves don't have rights. They're not going to put it in that terms, mind you. But they don't like this. This is one of the places, and you're seeing more and more of them. I could tell you some stories, and if there's questions, I will later. But anyway, bottom line is I've been signing things like this for literally years and years and years at this point. I would encourage you to begin to do so. Even if you don't completely understand what it's talking about, you can begin to do this. Like I said, it's not a necessary condition, but it's an indicator. Your fruit had better bear out the same concept. What you're doing is you're withdrawing consent. What you're doing is you're making a choice of law. What you're doing is you're indicating in writing, anytime you sign a contract, that, hey, even if you're telling me that there are adherent clauses, in other words, fine print, if you're telling me there's stuff here that you're not going to tell me about that's fraud, and you're going to come later and say, this means that I've given up my right to keep and bear arms, or that you're going to grope my kids, or take my stuff, I'm going to say, no, this contract is under choice of law that I indicated up front, is to be adjudicated, if you will, understood in terms of the common law. Because I serve a different master. I serve my creator. So I'll say it, in other words, when I speak it, a number of different ways, including all the ways I've just said it. I don't serve the state. I don't serve, you know, fill in the blanks, Cthulhu, Molech, Hasatan, Beelzebub, Washington, Brussels, London, the banksters. I don't serve any of them. I serve Yod-Heh, Vav-Heh, and him alone. Period. When it comes to choice of law, I will choose his instruction, his Torah. I keep his instruction, his Torah, first and foremost. Period. To the point where you claim that there is law that doesn't conflict with that, fine. When I make contracts, my word is my bond. Yeah, I'm going to let my yes be yes and my no be no, among other things. But my signature matters. My name matters, just like his does. When I sign my name, just like he does, it means I intend to do what I'm saying I'm going to do. I don't enter into fraud. And if you enter into fraud with me, I'm telling you up front that my choice of law is his. And how am I indicating that? With these words, without prejudice. So maybe that helps a little bit. Let me read what it says here now in very own, in their genuine print. From the Uniform Commercial Code. This is the thing that replaced the common law. But there's still a little bit, if you know where to look, of remedy in law. Now this is, again, I keep wanting to emphasize this, is necessary, but not sufficient. It's a good indicator. It alone is not enough. Because you can mess it up a bunch of different ways. As far as Big Brother's concerned, there's 1,000 ways to fall into the pit. And if he had his way, there'd be no way whatsoever to get out. But this one had to be there. UCC 1-308. Again, it's called Performance or Acceptance under Reservation of Rights. Withdrawing consent. A party, says Section A, a party, that would be you, hopefully, that with explicit reservation of rights performs or promises performance or assents to performance in a manner demanded That's generally what Big Brother does today. They demand, or offered by the other party, does not thereby prejudice the rights reserved. You'll hear people talk about all rights reserved, and so forth. Now, it says in this genuine print the following thing. Such words as, quote, without prejudice, unquote, or, comma, quote, under protest, or the like, are sufficient. I know people that will sign a traffic ticket. You got to sign this. Well, there's been, last time I had a traffic ticket, I just refused to sign it. I'm not signing this. Period. And, okay. And I have signed things like that. Some people will write under duress, or UD, or under protest. Okay? Cops, at least, nowadays, more and more, if you write under protest, they're going to say, that's a fracker. They're not going to let you sign that. I'll haul you off to jail. But for the most part, a lot of times, they don't even know what without prejudice means. My driver's license is signed without prejudice. Every single time a check gets written, it'll have the words without prejudice. I will tell people honestly nowadays, my signature, if I was ever to get asked under oath in a court of law, is this your signature? And they hand me a piece of paper, and it does not say without prejudice above my line, it is not my signature. With 100% certainty under oath, I can say, no, it's not. Because my signature always has the words without prejudice. Only place I ever got into a long discussion, took me an hour to rent a car. One time it was in Costa Rica. And the woman at the, I think it was Hertz or National office says, ¿Qué es eso, señor? Without prejudice. I said, that's my signature. No, not your signature. I said, do I know my signature or do you? It's my signature. Es mi firma. Todo. Sin esta parte, no es mi firma. If it doesn't have that word, it's not my signature. Oh, not, no. She wouldn't let me get away with it. Get away with it. I had to speak to several levels of management. And I made it very clear. You try turning this in without this, the bank is going to reject it because I'm going to make darn sure they do. Because it is not my signature. You want this contract signed? It's going to have those words on it because that is my signature. And again, what it says is the party is explicitly reserving their rights under what? Literally, under the common law. The rights are not being prejudiced. So if you have to sign a contract, especially if it's under duress, you can't have an internet connection without this. Make sure it says without prejudice. Are you accepting money from something? Because ultimately the whole point is going to be, well, you signed up for it, in for a penny, in for a pound. You took the bennies. You got it. We got you. Gotcha. And therefore you don't have rights. Let's talk about a couple other things. Did I miss any questions? Okay, I don't think so. I expected there'd be quite a few questions on this one. Maybe not. But let's talk about some things that I've mentioned in the past. These are just news stories from this week that kind of help to make all of this clear. Here's one of them. This is from Kurt Nimmo at PrisonPlanet.com. They have gotten a copy of the Illinois Department of Human Services, DHS, IDHS, a brochure. Now get this. This is about as satanic as you can find. Talk about something that's in your face. Now we have your signature. We're going to rape your Bill of Rights. It's called the IDHS Firearms Owners Identification Mental Health Reporting System, FOID. It's a brochure with all the official stamps of Big Brother's agencies on it. And in here it says, about confidentiality, this I thought was funny, HIPAA-compliant privacy requirements, and all patient information is confidential. It's in highlights. Except, of course, we know that it's not, because NSA's got it all anyway. So, all patient information is confidential except when it's not. In other words, what they're doing to you is they're lying in genuine print, and they're telling you it's HIPAA-compliant, and guess what? If you read the fine print, you'll find that any government bureaucrat with sufficient clout, if they can't tap it directly, can get to it indirectly. We've already found, for example, because it was in another one of the states, where somebody having a what they thought was privileged conversation with a mental health provider said, oh, you've got a gun. You must be a nutcase, because I'm scared of guns. Therefore, you scare me. Therefore, you're a danger to yourself and others. Therefore, I have to report this, because this is what Illinois is telling me. Get this. The law requires clinicians and facilities to report patients who own firearms that they believe pose a, quote, clear and present danger to themselves or others. Well, there you go. That's everybody, because we're scared of firearms. This is Illinois, isn't it? We've been told for years that if you've got a gun, you got a gun! No! By definition, you're a nutcase. Who would want a gun? This is the old Soviet scheme, okay? Why are you nutcase? Why are you therefore unable to keep and bear arms or even be a free man? Answer, because you're not serving the party. You're not a party member. You've withdrawn your consent. You what? You withdrew your consent from our God? You don't recognize the prince of this world? You know we're going to kill you, don't you? You must be a nutcase. Therefore, we've proven our own case. QED. IDHS says the brochure, I'm quoting, must be notified of anyone who communicates a serious threat of physical violence, blah, blah, blah. Here comes the key word. Or poses a clear and imminent risk of serious physical injury to himself or another person. Or demonstrates threatening physical or verbal behavior, such as violent, suicidal, or assaultive threats, actions, or other behavior. Here comes the catch-all. Or other behavior determined by you, the physician, clinical psychologist, or qualified examiner. In other words, if you say he's a nutcase, he's a nutcase, and we'll come and get his guns and take him away involuntarily. And by the way, here comes the threat. This is the other part, remember, of the consent. Guess who we will come after, Mr. Qualified Examiner, if you fail to report someone that we decide you should have reported. It's a crime, you know. So guess what your only safe course of action is, right? If he's got a gun, report him. DHS and the state of Illinois have attached the requirement to the issuance of a concealed carry license. Recognize the term of art, right? If it's a right, you don't have to ask permission. But if you're a slave, well, slaves don't have the right to do all kinds of things. And they need their master's permission. They need a license. They need a permit. So, these requirements are now attached to the concealed carry license and the FOID, the Firearm Owner's Identification Card, the mark, if you will. This new concealed carry law broadens the scope. So here's what happened. The Supreme Court said, uh-oh, you can't do this. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You got to find a more clever way to infringe. Oh, well, that's really easy. We'll just issue them a FOID, and then we can come and get them later. We're going to require them to tell us where they live, and that way we know where to break in at 3 in the morning if we want to. And we got all kinds of gotchas. We got this lengthy list of things here, or this, or this, or this, or basically if we say so, and we know you've got one, then we can come and take it. So the new carry law, says the DHS of Illinois secretary, broadens the scope of the Illinois FOIA mental health reporting system, both in terms of who must report and what information they must support. How clever. You thought it was a victory for the right to keep and bear arms? Gotcha! It also broadens the ability of the state to deny Illinois residents, get this, the right to practice the Second Amendment. If a doctor or other healthcare professional makes a subjective decision declaring that individual to be a clear and present danger to society. Now, in that sentence, there's about half a dozen terms of art. Who's a resident? Well, that's not the same thing as one who is domiciled in a particular place. And it's about denying rights? No. If it can be denied by the state, it's not a right, it's a privilege. And so forth and so on. So hopefully that makes the point clear. Is signing one of those things without prejudice? Well, I wouldn't sign one at all, to be honest with you. A FOIA or a concealed carry permit. Because ultimately what you're asking for is permission. Now, it's an interesting thing. You might spend years in a court of law trying to prove that you signed it without prejudice, and so therefore, you're still reserving your rights, reserving rights that you've just asked permission to exert. That would be an interesting one to sit on a jury for, wouldn't it? But, nevertheless, the claim, and this is where I'm headed with this whole without prejudice thing, it's why I'm illustrating it a number of different ways. There are people, myself included, who would say, look, you're going to have a heck of a time surviving in this society if you don't deal occasionally with dishonest weights and measures, with checks or with fake cash. You're going to have a heck of a time surviving without a job if you're still of working age and you don't have independent means. Not that you can't do it, not that you maybe oughtn't to be thinking about, you know, getting some land and farming and doing some other things where you can be a little bit more off the grid. If you want a, if you want to listen on Shabbat, you're going to have a heck of a time surviving without an internet connection. And you're going to have to sign something. So in all of those cases, simply because the legal argument boils down to there is a requirement. Remember what I just read? Where somebody reserves rights that have been demanded by the other party. And they can do this without prejudicing the rights reserved. So they're going to tell you, you can't have an internet connection without signing this. Well, I need one. Then I better sign it, and I better sign it without prejudice. Got another case here. Here's another one from Bob Unruh. A woman that had a permit. Now, this is here in Colorado. The new radical Colorado gun restrictions put in place a year ago have resulted in some catch-22s. Here's a woman that had a, quote, legal handgun. She had her permit. She was in a car crash, taken into custody by police. Well, the gun was taken into custody by police. She was taken to the hospital. And the police now say there's no legal way for them to return what she thought was her property to her, even though she is permitted to carry it. Do you see all the terms of art? She's a slave. Slaves need permits. She has the permit. She was taken to the hospital. The police have what she thought was her gun, but remember, she is permitted, not the owner. And though, even though they say it belongs to her, and the police don't really even want it, it turns out the gun cannot be transferred, because transferal is a term of art now. Back to the owner, it requires a federal firearms license check. And no one is qualified to do that from the police agency. Talk about a catch-22. What a scam! Okay? Now, you know, I'm not saying that if she had no permit and simply was to say, look, I'm not one of yours. I don't serve your master. It's my property, and I don't have to have permission. It's not a permitted piece of property. It's mine. Do you understand the difference? Well, we've got your signature here on this piece of paper saying you're a slave of the state. Well, no, you don't, because it doesn't say without prejudice. You can't show me anything that makes that claim. Now, you still got to deal with all kinds of Big Brother's minions in court, right? Which isn't necessarily a good thing. So that's why I keep reminding people this is not a silver bullet.
No, Doug
Cuckles, neck, Kelly. Yeah. We're joking here because I have don't know where the fellow is, haven't seen him in years, but I had a friend, I would call him, in the sheriff's department, later the police department, up in a little town called Buena Vista, Colorado, in the mountains, who understood the right to keep and bear arms. And it was very nice. And I've been blessed to know some peace officers, not to be confused with LEOs nowadays, peace officers who actually truly honored their oaths. And when a particular situation arose one time, and I was in a situation where a firearm had been stolen, and he brought it back to me, and I was surprised. It was the first time I met this gentleman. And he says, well, Mark, he says, if it was my gun, I'd want it back. And I said, I really appreciate that. And we became friends. We'd stop in and talk to him occasionally. And I asked him, once we got to know one another better, what are you going to do when you're told to do various kind of things that violate your oath? He said, well, when I have to, I'll move to Montana, and I'll go to smaller and smaller towns where I can still practice what I pledged to do. And when I can't, I guess it's time for me to retire. That's been a while ago, so probably he's retired, but I don't know that. May he rest and be blessed. Here's the story I was looking at a minute ago, and it makes the same point as well. This comes from Washington's blog, and it has to do with he in turn is quoting Glenn Greenwald from the Guardian, who was the fellow that released all of the Ed Snowden revelations. He's written a book called No Place to Hide, saying basically that there's a perception that Americans have, and indeed the world has, about the mass surveillance, that it's marginalized only to a deserving group of people who are doing wrong, bad people, and the abuses of power even being cheered on by those who just plain don't know better. And turns out that NSA, of course, has been conducting mass surveillance of everybody in violation of the U.S. Constitution. Some don't know what's going on. And he says this. He quotes some of the paperwork, some of the information that he's gotten, about how the NSA is plotting to use information that they have unlawfully, unconstitutionally collected against the people that they call, and now I'm quoting, by the way, this would include me, I suspect, and probably almost everybody that's listening here, that's not government paid. They call them radicalizers. These are people who the NSA itself admits are not terrorists. They do not belong to terrorist organizations, at least not that they know of, not yet. And they do not plan terrorist attacks. They simply express ideas that the NSA knows are radical, considers, he says, radical. They've collected all kinds of information having to do with their online sexual activity, chats of a sexual nature that they have had, pornographic websites they might visit, and they plan. And by the way, I'm going to suggest again, remember, they can turn on devices remotely and look at cameras and all kinds of stuff. So it may not even be online, folks. Who knows how much information they've got? And who knows whether it's even real or not? That's the point. They can make the stuff out of whole cloth. They don't have to even tell you what the source is. And they plan in the document on how to use this information to publicly destroy the reputations or credibility of those people to render them ineffective as advocates. And they even say that if you visit certain websites, like WikiLeaks or others, then they want to be able to undermine people. Anybody who challenges the authority of the government will be characterized as terrorist. We've been seeing all this stuff happening. All kinds of ways to get on the list. At this point, I'd have to say if people aren't on a list, you probably have to ask the question, are you really walking in obedience to Torah? I've got a story about the EPA land grab here. This is another one of the same things. If people think they own land, the EPA is in the process of, they just did this week, amended the so-called Clean Air Act. Hey, guess what that has to do with? Various other kinds of contracts that people have entered into once they've given up their rights and signed things without reserving those rights. And now the EPA reserves the right themselves to change the meaning of words. So the new Clean Air Act will include, as amended, temporary wetlands and waterways. They don't have jurisdiction from Congress. Congress doesn't have jurisdiction from the Constitution to do this anyway. They're just seizing the power. And so anywhere where it rains or where water collects or even through which water moves or when people water their lawn or there's runoff from seasonal ponds or streams or collection areas or puddles on your own property is now under the purview of the EPA. Well, for sure, I'll say it this way, for sure if you haven't at least reserved rights, if you've been signing things not carefully. Now, does that mean that if you've ever signed anything in the past, you've had it? Well, again, the thing to do is at least once you realize it, to admit and to know and to start walking properly from then on. That's about the best you can do. We got less than 10 minutes left, so if there's any questions, I need to get those up. And otherwise, we'll start to wrap it pretty quickly. I want to just do this story briefly because it's a great way to finish this. This comes from Foreign Policy. This is the propaganda arm of the Council on Foreign Relations. For you conspiracy theorists out there, they're right up there with the Illuminati and the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission. And the Jesuits, you know, on the scale of evil plotters in smoke-filled back rooms. And so here's Foreign Policy coming out and saying, you have to understand, this is both funny and it's in-your-face true. And that's why I'm doing this. The Pentagon has a plan to stop the zombie apocalypse. Seriously, they say. Everything you need to know about the U.S. military's defense strategy to protect humanity from the walking dead. Yes, they say, the U.S. military has always been the one place in government with a plan forever, preparing for anything. They got a blueprint off the shelf for any contingency. Do you need this? Do you need a response to a Russian nuke missile launch? Yep, they got it. How about a U.S. ambassador kidnapped by drug lords? Unless, of course, it was done at the behest of the U.S. government. Well, yep, got that one too. How about a detailed strategy for surviving a zombie apocalypse? Yes, as it turns out, check. Incredibly, the DOD has a response if zombies attack armed forces, and they needed to eradicate flesh-eating walkers to preserve the sanctity of human life. Now, all of this sounds like a great joke. It is intended to. And they're even going to admit that in the process of this. It says in here that this is a unclassified document on a military secret computer network that Foreign Policy has kindly made available for you to peruse. It's called CONOP 8888, the Zombie Survival Plan. And the authors in the summary of the plan say, quote, this plan fulfills fictional contingency planning tasking for U.S. SATCOM, our Strategic Command, to develop a comprehensive plan to undertake military operations to preserve non-zombie humans from threats posed by the zombie horde. Because zombies pose a threat to all non-zombie human life, Strategic Command is prepared to do, you know, yada, yada, yada. It's called Counter-Zombie Dominance. It's dated April 30 of last year. And they say this, it's no laughing matter, yet of course it is. Even the authors note in the document's disclaimer section, this plan was not actually designed as a joke. And you've heard me talk about this before. I call this the Clintonian truth. It's not a joke, but it is. This way we can rub it in your face. This way we can say, see, hey, we warned you. You thought we were kidding, but we weren't. Guess who the non-zombies are? Well, that would be just us. Guess who the non-humans are? Oh, that would be you. All you zombies. What did Soviet Russia do? Well, there was us and them. What did the Nazis do? Well, there's us and them. And the non-Aryans are also non-human. What are you Jews? What are you... What were the other ones? The ones that had the little carts and rolled around? The gypsies, yeah. Who are the gypsies? Those are all non-humans. Those would be called zombies in this document. So they built an entire plan, a training plan for doing this. And it reads like a joke, again, except it's not. Now, here's the line that I wanted to wrap with, and then we'll wrap it up. They were concerned. Planners realized that training examples need to accommodate the political fallout that could occur if the general public gets a hold of the document. Well, mistakenly believes that a fictional training scenario is actually a real plan. No. The fact that we have at Camp Lejeune a little town that looks complete with Baptist church, like any town America, does not mean we're planning to invade any town America. The fact that every three-letter agency's got ballistic vests and jacketed hollow-point bullets doesn't mean we're planning on doing what it looks like we're planning on doing. No, we need to have a disclaimer. So, what we did, it says here, is we elected to use a completely impossible scenario that could never be mistaken for a real plan. To which I add, well, just like disarming the American people, the 29-POM survey, or like the naked body scanners, that could never happen in America, or like universal NSA spying in violation of that could never happen in America. Hell, they lied about it for two decades or more. This is a creative endeavor for training purposes only. Yeah, don't believe it. The plan reviews extensively all this good stuff. When you begin to see how things are beginning to play out and what's going on and why it is so important that we come out, well, then we begin to realize that there are all these other things that we need to do too. I started by talking about the elements of what we're at today. A stark choice. Idolatry. Come out of it. Absolutely. Show yourself. Approve. Study. How do you separate yourself? How do you come out of her? Well, answer. Whole lot of things. Lots of necessary but not sufficient conditions. First, turn from idolatry. Keep my feasts, my Sabbaths. Walk in my statutes and judgments, commandments. Do these things. Let your Elohim be made obvious by your fruit. And there are some other things too. Not silver bullets, but important. Right without prejudice when it comes to dealing with the secular world. It's not going to make the chains fall off. But on the other hand, it's not going to hurt. Because, well, if it does hurt, guess what? Simply living in that world is going to be made increasingly impossible. You're going to see more and more efforts made, by the way, to make sure that people can't do this. Just like we're going to see more and more efforts to make sure that people won't be able to buy or sell, but that they have the mark. Don't take the mark, period, even if you're right without prejudice. Right? You know that. But on the other hand, up until then, as you get in the process of coming out, the more that you can do to make it very clear that you do not serve their master, the more it is that we need to be able to be aware of that. If we're going to be cherem, or devoted, make sure that we're devoted to the right thing. So we've only got a couple minutes left. Again, I didn't see any other comments or questions, so let's just pray. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad, Abba, we thank you. We come before you. We thank you for your word. We thank you that your word is true. We thank you for the promises and for your covenant and that you'll remember this covenant no matter how bad things get, no matter where we are scattered and how lost out in the world we think we may be. We pray that you would give us eyes to see and ears to hear. Help us to speak your truth boldly. Help us, Father, not to be silent when we see the things that are going on. When we see the sword coming upon the land, let us blow the shofar and let us do the other things that we need to be doing so that it is clear to everyone that we serve you and you alone, and that we're walking in accordance with your statutes and your statutes and your commandments and your judgments and your instruction. Father, bless us. Help us to be together in you. Bless our communities. Help our communities to walk and to be separate. Guide us through these things that lie ahead. Help us to be counted worthy to escape what's coming. And Father, we pray that you would bring peace to us, and that those that would call themselves your enemies and thus ours, well, that there would be friendly fire, and that there would be chaos among their ranks, and that you would protect us, because we're not going to make fresh flesh our arm or put our faith in man. We put it in you and you alone. Help us to walk that out, we pray. In your Kedusha name, we ask all of this. Hallelujah. Amen.
Never will I go back. I have found my way. Called by my Father, I am here to stay. As long as I'm obedient and listen to His words, diligently study, then I will be heard. Depart from the wicked and their evil ways. Don't be partakers. You got to behave. It's not enough to be a hearer, doer. You must be praising, giving thanks to Yahweh for His love, His mercy. Out of her, my people, that's what He told me. Is it a physical matter and not just spiritual need? It's all come together in worship in His name, praising our Father, praise be to Yahweh. When we stand before Him in Yahshua.